Hi, Borach. That's what we're up to. As you can see on the board. Anybody want to bring up anything from our last Sigya, which we did very quickly? Spend one day on it. So we can move quickly if we go through Sigyas like that. I don't have so much more to say. I just want to introduce the main issue of what's called Samlacha Zakinyan, where it comes from, how it can be supplemented by Maisa Kinyan, how it's different from a real Maisa Kinyan. I'm sure we could come back to it later on. Does anybody want to raise anything now before we move on? Gabe, Yakir, Cole, anybody on here want to raise something about Askalas Hamalacha as a Kenyan? Okay, sounds like no. Can you guys hear me? Okay, excellent. So let's jump into Boreach Mibeso Asurim. Now this is connected to our past two sugyas that we've been discussing. Firstly, we're interested in what counts as a meeting of the minds, what counts as a binding agreement. Sechiras Poelim seems to work through, there's some background discussions, some background negotiations, and it's those background negotiations that then become binding on the parties. That was two sugyas ago, right? What constitutes a meeting of the minds? What conditions have to obtain for there to be a meeting, etc.? The last sugya, which we saw on Thursday, was about Haskalas HaMalacha as a Kinyan, that if there's a background meeting of the minds, it's consummated, it becomes binding through the beginning of performance, through Haskalas HaMalacha as a Kinyan. Now, it sounds like there's going to be one exception to this rule, maybe one exception to both of these rules, is agreements made under extraordinary circumstances. Or, another way of putting that, without taking too much of a stand on the interpretation of this next sugya, is an extraordinary agreement or kind of an exaggerated agreement that's reached maybe even under regular circumstances. So what we're looking for today is circumstances that will break the earlier rules that we've seen, either because the price amount is so exaggerated or because the conditions are just too extreme to warrant Halacha recognizing the agreement as binding. So our discussion really starts with the sugya in Bava Kama Kuf Tes Vav Amud Aleph. Anybody want to tell me just the basic issues in Kuf Tes Vav Amud Aleph? The discussion in the Mishnah there, Zeva B'chaviso Shal Yayin, Zeva B'kadu Shal Dvash. Okay, so I'll just say the facts of the case are very simple in the Mishnah. I'm carrying a barrel of wine. What? So I'm carrying a barrel of wine. You're carrying a barrel of honey. The barrel of honey breaks and begins to, I guess, to spill. So what I do is I immediately pour out the contents of my wine barrel to save your honey. So in the Gemara's, in the Mishnah's first pass, it says, if there was no bargain for agreement, there was no, Cole, maybe just mute the background noise. The Gemara says, if there's no background agreement, background meeting of the minds, then all I get is the going market rate for the service. I can't recoup the loss of my wine, right, that I poured out to save your honey. But the Mishnah says, "Im amar asiel shelchav afanosin li dame sheli." But if there's some sort of background stipulation, some sort of background agreement on price, I say I'm going to save your stuff, and you're going to compensate me for my losses. Then chayav liten lo, then that's binding. That's very consistent with what we've seen until now, right? Without a background agreement, all you get is scharo haroylo, right? Just to get the going market rate. But if there is a background agreement, then that amount is what is decisive. So if there's a background agreement here that you'll pay my costs, then chayav liten lo, you're obligated to give them to me. Eitan, you had a quick question?
Yeah, so I'm just assuming that the case is you're both here walking and something happens with the barrel breaks, and you don't have enough time to be like, hey, let's just make an agreement.
Not necessarily, right? Maybe there's like, you don't get that sense from the Mishnah that there's immediate urgency.
Okay, 5 seconds. It's fine. Right. It's full slowly.
That's right. It's viscous. It's low viscosity.
High
viscosity means it goes slower.
Yeah, it's thicker. It flows slower.
Yeah. All right, so it's highly viscous and therefore goes slowly. Good. If we were in my father's share, we would say, "Oh, Torah Mada, we get physics credit." That's right.
He would talk to Joe. He would call out Joe.
Right. Okay, so the Gemara on Kuf Tes Zayin comments on this and says, wait a second, why is it the case that if there's a background negotiation of Im Atzil Eshachat and Nosein Li Demei Shali, why should that be binding? And I assume the Mishnah thinks that there was consent from the other part, from the other party, there was acceptance. But the Gemara here says, V'neimalei Mishat Anibacha. Why can't the victim, the guy who's suffering the loss, so not the saver, why can't the person who's losing his merchandise, the victim, say, Mishat Anibacha, I was just messing around when I promised to cover your costs. Milo Tanya, didn't we learn? Harishai Borechim Beis Asurin, V'haisim Aboros Lefanov. So the guy who is the convict was running away from jail, and there's a ferry. Amar lo told Dinar Behavirani, he says, I'll pay you this exorbitant fee to get me across. Eino elascharo, right? That background agreement that the exorbitant fee doesn't hold. All he gets is the going market rate for ferry services. Yeah, ferry services. Very highly, very underrated and unappreciated in America where you have bridges everywhere. When's the last time you took a ferry? I was in Germany 2 years ago. It was great. We were driving on one side. Not with your car.
Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, Martha's Vineyard, that's right. Martha's Vineyard.
You wouldn't know.
But I'm talking Mamish like the ferry that they're talking about here. First of all, I was just a few weeks ago I went to the where Washington crossed the Delaware near Trenton. So there's Washington Crossing Park or something. And they have like old ferries from the 1700s. 1700s, I think.
Yeah.
1700s. Yeah, where like literally Washington like crossed the Delaware with like these small little ferries. They put all the artillery and horses, and they went one by one on these ferries. Great. It's like the
ferry. The best way to get across from southern Manhattan to New Jersey.
They say, yeah, take the ferry now. I was also in. We were in Germany 2 years ago. And the GPS literally told me to, it showed me like driving into the Rhine River. It's like, make a right here. And then you go, I'm like, you can't go right. The water's right there. At Glei Milsa, there was a ferry station right there where you're supposed to drive your car onto a ferry and the ferry takes you across.
Really?
Yeah. It was really cool. It was like a little flat boat.
I took the ferry when,
it wasn't like a Martha's Vineyard ferry. It was,
cool. You go from
that. Yeah.
You can take your car onto the ferry to Vineyard.
Right, I know you could, those are huge ships. This is like a little ferry. This is like a, 30 by 30 feet or something, where you literally, just takes your car across. Isn't that great?
You drove in Germany?
Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah. Slow relative to the speed people are going on the Autobahn. But we're a little too far afield right now.
No speed limit?
Well, no, we could talk about it a different time. So the Mishnah says that if you promise this exorbitant fee to get across the river, it doesn't matter that there was this background agreement, Ein lo ela scharo. All the ferry guy gets is the going rate for the services. So Alma, you see that you could say Mishat Ani Becha, so why don't we apply the same principle to the honey guy and the wine guy across the wine guy traveling on the road. So the Gemara says, no, because there are actually two different ferry cases. There's a Reisha and a Seifa. The Meshata Anibacha argument works in the Reisha, but in the Seifa, the Meshata argument doesn't work, and actually the parties are bound by the stipulated price agreement. Right? And here's a quote from the Seifa. Amar lo tol dinar ze bischarcha behavirani. If he says, tol dinar ze as your schar, then nosein lo schar mishalim. So the Gemara asks, Maishna Reisha, Maishna Seifa. It sounds like the same case repeated. So it says, no. Bitzayir Ashola Dagim in Ayam. So the ferry guy is suffering a loss. He has certain costs in getting you across the river. Those costs is the opportunity cost of losing out on his fishing proceeds, right? He was going to make a lot of money fishing. He has to give up his fishing to help you get across. If he's suffering a loss to help you, then the background stipulation is binding. Okay, so there's a Reisha and a Seifa case. Generally speaking, it sounds like the argument of Meshata and Yibacha works, but if there's some sort of hefsid going on, then the stipulated agreement is binding. And we'll have to figure out why, and we'll get to that in a second. Let me just point out There are two other sugyas I want to bring to your attention that also are built off this paradigm of Barachmi Beis Asurim. So the Gemara in Bava Kamma, same sugya in Kuf Tezayin Amud Aleph, talks about you hire somebody to bring medicine to a chola. That's a socher sepo lahavi kruve, whatever, to a chola. Turns out the chola dies. Tosos reads the Gemara saying that all things considered, if you promise to pay an exorbitant fee, an exorbitant price for the medicine, the agreed upon price is not binding. All right, so if you agreed to pay Yosem Rimasha Hayaroy Lesokro, you could argue, assuming there's no external hefsid, Meshatani Becha. So you go to the pharmacy says, we can't give you this medicine. You say, I'll pay $1 million for it. Oh, they say, sure, we'll do it for that money. You get the medicine, you're not obligated to pay them $1 million. You just pay the going market rate. Okay, so similar principle, but with the sale of goods. At least in the way Tosos reads that Gemara. Well, this is Tosos, Bava Kamma Kuf Tezayin. Yeah. Might have a different view. The Gemara in Yevamos Kuf Vav has another application of this general principle. Yoni, you want to tell us what's going on in Yevamos Kuf Vav?
What's about chalitza?
Yeah.
That's a basic context. Whether or not chalitza mutet, if you trick the guy into thinking that you're going to pay him afterwards.
That's right.
Money for doing the service of being a chalitza. So you don't actually, if the chalitza works, you don't actually pay him at the end.
Yeah, right. So the classic case, the wife wants chalitza, the brother-in-law wants ibun. She, over her dead body, right, she doesn't want to get stuck with the brother-in-law. So how do you can't really compel the husband, you know, the brother-in-law, to do chalitza rather than ibun. So in the Gemara, they come up with this trick to deceive him and trick him into doing chalitza. How do they do that? So Yoni tells us they promise to pay him off 200 zuz if he does chalitza. Now, the Gemara says that if you say do chalitza amanas, I will give you 200 zuz. Is that binding, Yoni? Do they have to pay him? No. Right? Because of the paradigm of the Boreach Mibes HaAsurim, and you could argue, Meshatani Bukha, I was just messing around, I wasn't serious in coming to an agreement on this price. So a similar principle, right? Okay, so what are we supposed to take away from these cases? What's the underlying halachic principle that explains the halachic rule over here? Thoughts? Okay, here.
I mean, what I'm inferring from the formulation of Meshatani Bukha is that we're making a claim that das. We know from the from a third party perspective of halacha, we know that people don't really mean these claims. There's no real meaning of the mind of this price. You know, at least one party knew that wasn't going to happen. Even both parties knew it wasn't going to happen, and so this agreement never took place.
Yeah, so you're saying that there's something about the exaggerated price that gives us reason to believe that there's no real meeting of the minds here.
Right.
Right, so the parties, with their rationality intact, could not have reasonably believed that this was a binding agreement. Is that the... I mean, they should have known, given the circumstances, that this was kind of just an inducement.
So it's not clear to me if the expectation is one party knows, the other party doesn't know, or really both parties know, just like a
but whatever it is, there was no real meeting of the no gemiras das for halachic purposes.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's going to be one good way of reading, reading the sugya for sure. So really, it boils down to gemiras das. Does anybody have another way of trying to make sense of the underlying principle? Yoni, do you have an alternative way or?
I mean, it sounds like contracts made under duress might not be valid.
Yeah, so maybe there's a principle of duress, then it's an interesting question whether duress itself reduces to gemiras das, that we're assuming that you couldn't have had the requisite intent under duress. But yes, you could read duress differently and say that duress is its own consideration, right? Maybe there's gemiras das, just the halacha doesn't want to bind people to agreements made under a lot of pressure, right? Even if it would otherwise be considered gemiras das.
Yeah.
It's just like a good rule to have that we don't want to bind people to agreements that they're pressured into. Any other thoughts on this?
Is the idea that this is like a kind of a masala? Yeah.
Wow. Put it to a vote. I never heard Amsala. Is that what they say in Gush these days? Amsala?
Amsala. I think it's like one of the words.
Right. Right.
What do you say? What is?
I said Amsala. Amsala. Yeah.
Is that your father says?
Probably. Chazaka. Whatever I say is, you know, what I received from the Masorah. Right, so you want to say it's an amasla kol?
The idea is that, like, you know, the reason I'm thinking about this is because we just learned this idea of towing the clothes for towing, but yeah, it actually seems like a very parallel case. So basically, we trust you to, we give you, like, a benefit if you can provide some kind of excuse then about, like, why you said, you know, what it is you said, and you know, but really, you know, you had something different in mind or something like that. So even if, you know, there's some kind of, like, reason to bind you, in this case, because there was another Sardat greed, in the case of Sardat, because there were agents who came and remained.
Right.
So we allow you to
wiggle out.
We allow you to provide, like, some kind of
excuse.
You're interpreting your life here. The idea is, like, the amasla is there's just one, which is,
yeah,
you know, I needed to get this thing done, and I had to tell the reason.
That's right. I think that's one way of looking at.
You would need an independent, like, standard for what counts as a, you know, obviously, you know, I really wanted to. I'm trying to get, like, what wouldn't be a good justification. Like, you know, I was late for a movie that I had to see The Irishman or whatever. And the only way to get you to take me across the river was to offer you, you know, $1,000. That would be so tough.
The Irishman was good.
Yeah. I see. Yeah, I agree with that characterization, right? So it would be Gemira's Das, but we allow you to, given the situation of duress, we allow you to interpret it away and get out of it through this claim of a shat ani b'cha. Another way we might look at this. I think he's saying this as an interpretation of duress. Yeah, but he's saying that, oh, there was Gemira's Das, but you could get out of the Gemira's Das through.
I mean, I don't think part of the question would be the duress, like, how you define
Gemira's Das.
And duress, generally.
Yeah.
Duress, is it a mitzvah, is it not a mitzvah?
Yeah. We'll get to that. I think a third. Yair, do you want to weigh in on the third?
No, I just want to. You used this formulation before that, you know, oh, if there is a Gemira's Das, we'll, like, let you wiggle out of it with this taina.
Yeah.
That was an interesting formulation today, right? Like, halacha's no way to be playing around with words that talk about Das, but really what it's doing is, you know, protecting people from being, you know, extorted under duress.
Yeah.
Which is the way that halacha talks. We wouldn't be able to get away with it if we said we're protecting people under duress, so we're going to frame it as.
So why do you even need that? Why do you need the framing of no dot? Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm okay with jettisoning the Meshat Ani B'cha as important to the Sugya. And maybe that's the Gemara just throws that in as, you know, for good measure. But the real principle is that an agreement under duress is not binding. Right, Nafkamina is what happens if you have this agreement. And he doesn't say Meshat Ani B'cha. He just says, I was forced into it. Right, so the party doesn't claim that it was a joke.
Right.
Right, so it's interesting, nafkamina, what happens in that kind of situation.
Yeah.
Yoni.
Maybe like a third approach would be like, in cases where a mitzvah is being performed, or a potential mitzvah, halacha compels the other party, person who has the option of performing a mitzvah, to do so at reasonable cost.
That's another. I think that's another way. Meaning, what's really going on here is kind of an ona sugya. That the halacha is really interested in just stipulating and keeping agreements to fair prices, right? What's considered the fair price for this kind of a service? Now, sometimes parties could bargain around that, but not always, right? Not always. And so, for example, mitzvah, if the performer of the duty has an antecedent duty to do this thing at a certain rate, then that can't be superseded by a contractual or a weekly contractual agreement, right? So there's something about either the duty or the correlative claim right that the other party has for you to perform this service at market rate, right? You see that? And it takes a very strong kind of agreement to override that claim right that the party has. So given that I have a claim right against you to provide the service at a certain price, so it could only be overrided by something very strong. And this kind of background negotiation with Haskalas HaMelacha is not sufficient to override the claim right to provide the service, the mitzvah service, at the halachic default. Right?
I don't really see like any language here to suggest that you have a right. Like, I think that the default in this case is that the agreement and the cases we've seen earlier, so far this year, like the default is that, first of all, there's no enough for default. Right? It's not like a general rule.
Oh, it's a machlokas rishonim.
How do we talk in? Whether that's a thing is. Wait, you're saying that if I agree with you to going rate is fine, and you and I agree that you're going to perform the task under perfect information, okay? That you're saying that my locus for showing how possible in that case, whether I can go back and claim an invalid agreement?
Well, hold off on the Ono question. Right, yeah. Hold off on the Ono question. But what's the substantive point you want to make?
The point I'm going to make is that I just don't think, if you believe that, like, basically we allow people to contract for the services they want at the prices they stipulate, then there isn't, it's difficult to say there's some claim right to the service at the...
In cases of a mitzvah. Right. In cases of a mitzvah. Right. I think that's the fourth. Exactly. That's Yoni's point. So, right. I don't want to say, right, Yoni, you don't want to say, and I don't want to say that there's a claim right to always the fair market value. It's when there's a claim right. There's a claim right against the performer when it's a mitzvah.
Yeah.
Right? Because he has some special duty to perform it.
In theory, we had a claim that the halacha obligates to have a fair price.
Yeah. Correct. Correct. Right. We're in the narrower case of mitzvah performance.
So you're claiming that there's a mitzvah for mitzvah.
Although I wonder whether it's the claim right of the mitzvah. Now I wonder whether it's the marketing back to our discussion for listening to that day at the beginning of the semester. I wonder whether if you have a claim right, what's the first principle here? Like, is it if you have a claim right to the performance of the mitzvah? I would probably say that you have no right to charge more for the mitzvah.
Yeah.
The mitzvahs are obligations, are first person, not, right?
Well, let's see. I want to say that in Bin Adam Lechavero mitzvahs, you have a claim right against the other person to provide it to you. We're going to see this in a few minutes, so let's hold off on that discussion until we get to that part of the source sheet. So now I want to sketch the basic principles that we've shown and bring to bear in analyzing the sugya. Yes, yeah, you can make an observation.
That kind of argument, we're going to have to assume that we have mitzvahs, let's say a mitzvah to be masters, a substantial amount of money in order to save your money.
I have a duty to save.
I'm assuming for the moment that wine is more expensive than honey, but
right.
I don't know anything about the economics. So.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Something like that. We have duties of assistance, even if they come at a cost to us. Maybe the halacha provides for my recovery of those costs, but generally speaking...
Which, it doesn't in this case, right?
Even if
the deal is just recovery of the costs.
In that first case in the Mishnah, we don't know that there was a real duty to assist. Right? Because we're not really talking about that first case where I'm losing at your expense, right? So the Gemara says, I suffer my own loss if I'm helping you.
Well, so then this principle won't explain the first case.
But I'm just saying that we don't know if that first there really is a mitzvah in a case where my loss is greater than your loss. That's all I'm saying.
I was saying it could only be.
Right. I was a fool. I was a fool for actually saving you, right? In that kind of a case. The halakha, I mean, I'm not supposed to in under those conditions.
Okay.
So, the Rishonim distinguish between, remember the Reisha case of Boreach Mibeis Asurim and the Seifa case? In the first case, you're not bound by the stipulated amount. You just pay the going market rate for the ferry service. In the Seifa case, you are bound by the stipulated price. Why? So the Mishnah Gemara said because Cole, just put your thing on. Put the background noise on mute. In the Seifa case, you are bound. Why?
You suffered a loss.
Because the provider suffered a loss. Now, seems to be a machlokas we've shown him here. What kinds? How does the loss interact with his entitlement to collect the stipulated for rate? Right. So the guy would have been fishing, he would have made money off fishing, so that entitles him now to the exorbitant price that the convict agreed to pay him. So this sounds actually like this machlokas we've shown him here. From Rashi and the Meiri, Rashi on the Sugya and the Meiri on the Sugya, you get the sense, here's Rashi, that the case just so happens to be that the convict pledged to pay an amount that would compensate the ferryman for his losses. So the exorbitant price, it was exorbitant relative to ferry services, but it was actually quite fair considering the loss that the ferryman would suffer. Right, so there's a kind of equivalency between the hefzid and the schar that was pledged, and it's only in that case that the ferryman can recover the stipulated for amount. That makes a lot of sense, right? It's very intuitive. So Rashi here says, the absent of Kari Bezuza, that you're agreeing to pay him because he's suffering the loss in fishing, behind the bischaro, dikatami, told dinar, bischar sha'ata mafsikan, bitabi rain. Right? Take a dinar as compensation for your fishing losses and take me across the bridge. So then, those are also schar mishalim. Right? So it sounds like Rashi wants to say that the stipulated for amount is only binding when it was explicitly in consideration for the losses that the fisherman was gonna suffer.
What if it wasn't the exact same amount?
Or, not. I don't know if it has to be the exact same, or that it's a reasonable bargain.
Say it wasn't one dinar, it was 2 dinars, or something.
Yeah, so I think you have to figure out, is that a reasonable bargain? And if not, then it's not binding. And look at the Meiri also. Meiri says, "V'im haya zeh batal mimalacha acheres shehaya marviach ba dinar kishir zeh." Right, the guy is batal from malacha from which he would have gained a dinar, which is the shir zeh that the convict is pledging to pay him. So I think what these Rishonim are getting at, right? So notice it's tol dinar bischar mashani mevat lecha, notin lo dinar mishalei. I think these Rishonim are getting at a theory of fair market pricing, right? So they're saying the distinction between the Reisha and the Seifa case is that in the Reisha case, just the price is totally not fair. It's exorbitant to pay a dinar for the ferry service, and therefore the halacha strikes it down. In the Seifa, it's not exorbitant to compensate somebody who's losing, let's say, 3/4 of a dinar, to pay him a dinar for that plus the service. So it sounds like on these Rishonim's view, the idea is that the stipulated background amount's got to be reasonable. And only if it's reasonable are we going to enforce it. The Rush in Bava Metzia in the second parak, Simon Chav Ches, seems to disagree. What's the Rush's view? Did anybody get to see the last line in the Rush? Any of our web members get to see the last line in the Rush?
Yeah.
Was that a yes?
Yeah, the loss triggers the... the loss triggers the an obligation to pay. You appear your right to do so according to market value if there's any loss to the other seller.
That's right. And if there's any loss, how much are you entitled to recover?
You're entitled to recover... Even if not.
No, say it again, Cole. If the ferryman is suffering a minor loss and the stipulated for amount is exorbitant, right? So he's suffering a loss of $100, but he was they stipulated to pay.
Yeah, if your Facebook stock tests and you come out to top stock low, you recover nothing, I think.
No, you get everything. Right? If the ferryman is suffering a small loss, that entitles...
Oh, you think the subject of the verb ye is...
The ferryman. The ferry, the ferry, the ferry owner. The ferry person.
Wait, sorry. They agree on 100. The ferry owner has a loss of 1. The ferry owner gets it, right?
Yeah. He gets his 100.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
Okay, good. So that's different from Rashi and the Meiri. Rashi and the Meiri were saying that the reason why the ferryman gets the price is because the price was just compensation for the losses he was suffering. What the Rush here seems to say, what the Rush does say, is no. Kivan sheyesh lo ktsas hefsid yitol kol ma shepasak lo. Right? The moment that he suffers some minor loss, that's going to entitle him to the full amount that he was promised by the rider, by the convict. So why does that make sense? Right, what's the underlying theory there? What? This is the Rush.
You're asking about the Rush, not...
Yeah, I'm asking that. The Meiri, you understand, right? The Meiri's in Rashi's camp. It's all just about fair pricing, right? Is the compensation just? Does it make sense? Is it reasonable? For the Rush, even if the compensation is not reasonable...
You get to define the value of your own losses. I mean, like, don't say, for the same reason that you can, in theory, agree to, whatever price you want for labor, you can... I mean, that is basically the case where there's no loss, what basically is then NSL profit. So you probably right. I mean, especially the case where there is a half day, so you get to choose as a commercial actor what you charge others for taking things away from you, and they can agree or they can disagree. In the case where they agreed in advance, right? The idea is in the case where they didn't agree in advance, you could have been my colleague. Within the Russian general approach, between a case where you gave them the money in advance or you didn't. Yeah, that's a theoretical possibility. But the Russian is my colleague. He says that even in a case where you didn't pay him up front, if you agreed. So there, you're basically, you as the escaped prisoner are assuming responsibility for however the, by promising a certain amount of money, are assuming the responsibility for whatever loss, if there is a loss, is borne by unjust not to pay him if he's losing something if you promise to pay him.
Yeah, so there's definitely, I think you're definitely right that there's, he's saying that there's something about the loss which suddenly makes the stipulated for agreement much more serious, right? So if he's just providing a service in a kind of zenen of zelochaser thing, in a zenen of zelochaser scenario, so you still have the right to say mashat ani b'cha. But it sounds like the moment he's suffering, he has a cost, he has some sort of loss in order to provide the service, then you could take, either way Cole put it, that he has the right to define like the value of incurring the cost, or just that you don't have a right to claim Mishat Anibacha in the face of his losses, right? You can't say, I was joking, this wasn't a real agreement, when he suffered certain costs at your expense, at the expense of providing the service for you.
I think it's better to say that the basic case is not the... In the case of that, it's then or not there. Basically, what you're saying, that is not the standard case. Because they're basically like the ferryman. What you're saying about the ferryman is that you don't have a right. About the ferryman is that he doesn't have a right to charge for, because there was no... He's not bearing any cost. The standard case is when, he does have to do something extra for you. And then that just calls, making an intercept any, just like any other phone call. Like, he does work, and you pay him for the work.
Ah, so you want to say it's like the exceptional case of the Risha is like a Zenan of a Zelo Chasar scenario.
Yeah, I know where it says in that word, because it, you know, it's building up that, yeah, I think absolutely.
But the real principle is, oh, if there's, every service has a cost, and then you got to pay him like any service agreement, kefi scharo, kefi the stipulated amount.
Yeah, I mean, this is related, by the way, to, you know, I don't know if you want to get into this, but I think it can be very interesting. The discussion you were having about Maria Hari is, like, very relevant.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we want to get dragged into Zenan Zelo Chaser and all those discussions right now. But yes, I see their relevance. So what do you guys think? Are you guys on board for this idea that... So Cole has a bit of a chiddush here. He wants to say the real principle here is anytime you make an agreement, you're entitled to be compensated unless it's Zenan Zelo Chaser. Or do you think the Rush is saying something stronger, that there's something about suffering a hefsid that annihilates the other party's ability to claim Meshachta Mikha? Right? So Meshachta Mikha just doesn't work when there's a certain gravity to the opposing party's loss.
Makes sense.
Right?
I'm glad.
What? Which one? Yeah, this variation of that.
I mean, like, I don't think Cole's claim is, like, absurd in general. I just don't think it fits well in the Rush. Especially in the Rush, like, later on talks about whether the bio are there or not there, if they were there, you should admit it's not explicitly, right? If you should be getting that, I mean, then the very next line, if the bio are there, so then if your fault for anything, not explicitly, like if your fault, like your fault, so to speak, for not saying something. And if the poll's right, that you're then enter the chassid as a general rule.
It shouldn't matter whether the bio is there.
Or not, you should have to pay.
That's an interesting point. I had the rest of the Rush here until I took it off. Right? Yeah. I'm going to take another look at those last lines. Remind me later on if you look at it. So, I do think, though, the Rush here, the important machlokes in the Rush on the one hand and Rashi and the Yuri on the other hand, part of the Rashi and the Yuri. So, the Seifa case is when there's reasonable symmetry between the loss and the stipulated price. According to the Rush, even when there's no reasonable symmetry, there's something about the ferryman suffering a hefsid that vitiates the other party's ability to claim a shot on Yibacha. Cole, can you just put your phone on background noise on mute?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. So that's one very important distinction. That's implicit in the Gemara's distinction. What the Gemara seems to say is that the Reisha is a case where the ferryman would not have been fishing, and the Seifa is a case where he would have been fishing. Other Rishonim zero in on a different distinction between the Reisha and the Seifa. So look at closely at the language of the Gemara. What's the language of the Reisha and what's the language of the Seifa? Gabe or Yakir, do you guys want to pipe in also? If you want to Wayne or Ben, do you? Yakir or Gabe, you want to weigh in on the distinction between
Zeb is Kharcha.
Yeah. Good. Dinar Zeb is Kharcha versus that formulation is not there in the Risha. So what do you what would that suggest? Yakir, what would that suggest?
I haven't seen the Risha yet, but maybe some sort of maybe the specificity, and is that somehow relevant?
Very close. Very close. So what do you guys think? Yoni, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I've seen her reading all the time.
Yeah, so what's his point? What's it been Yonason's point?
I mean, he suggested the distinction of whether or not you gave money.
See, now we know that Yakir thinks, you know, like a Rishon, but, you know, close to a Rishon, but not exactly like a Rishon. Right, Yakir? Fine, at least maybe you think like a Rishon, but not like Rabbeinu Yonasan. Maybe it's not like Rabbeinu Yonasan.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. All right, okay, yeah, Yoni. So what's how do they make sense of the told dinar Zeb is Farfa?
In case where you already gave the money and where you haven't given the money yet.
That's right. He wants to say that the Risha is a case where you just pledge, there's a stipulated agreement about how much you're going to pay, But the SAFA is a case where you actually front the payment, right? You pay the ferryman before he provides the service. Here's the Meiri's point. Meiri says, I think this is quoting Rabbi Yonasan, the imparo kodem shayavor, if the convict pays before he crosses the river, ach harishona in kofenos olahachsi loklam, then the ferryman doesn't have to give back any of the money that he received in advance. So it sounds like the stipulated for amount is binding if you front the cash payment, but not if you're just going to pay after the fact. Here's Rabbi Yonasan's formulation. Here's the seifa. She'im nasan lo miyado liyado kodem she'yikanes b'ma'abores dinar zahav shuv einu yachal lomar m'shatani b'cha kivan she'paro. So what's the distinction between the cases? The fact that you fronted payment in the seifa, that makes the agreement binding. So how do you make sense of that? Why should the mere fact that you fronted payment, why should that make the stipulated amount binding? Notice the Meiri quotes a day that disagrees with this. After he quotes the Rabbeinu Yonasan Shita, he says, V'yesh poskim, she'im ratza zet tovo l'din u'machzir kol she'yesh sham yosar al-scharo. No. Even if you front the payment, you could still recover in bezin afterwards and make sure that the ferryman gives you back everything above the fair market value of the service. It's interesting, Machlokes Rishonim, whether the lechatchila payment, b'dieved payment, whether that really makes a difference. So how do you explain that Rabbeinu Yonasan view? Why would the fronting the payment make a difference?
If perspective is sort of like a das approach, like you would never actually pay this amount. The fact that you're fronting the amount shows that there is something in all of that. This is a real, I'm trying to say it, like this is like a real thing. This is a real amount that exists, and it's not like some figurative placeholder for what we're actually going to pay.
I think that's a good way of looking at it. So you're saying that payment reflects a certain kind of gemiras das.
Right.
Right? So just as I think we saw this in the end of the last chabura on Thursday, that a maisa kinyan that supplements this verbal agreement followed by a skalas hamalacha would bind in this kind of case. Right? So to actual nesinas hakesef, right? So this whole idea of, oh, maybe there was no meeting of the minds, and mishat ani b'cha, etc., etc., those all exist when things remain in the abstract world of promises and just commencement of performance. But when there's performance of nesinas hakesef, that shows that the parties are serious. Right? I think that's a nice way of putting it.
Within that transaction, the guy takes it, doesn't say, like, oh, no, obviously we're not actually going to do this.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that would point that it's just a Gemiras Das issue. Right? So and you know we're on the fence about Gemiras Das when things remain in the abstract. So just the stipulated verbal stuff and maybe even Aschalas HaMelacha is too abstract, right? Too loose in for Halacha. But if it's made concrete through a Nesinas HaKesef, then we know that there's real Gemiras Das here and there's intent to go forward. Yeah, correct. But notice if you went for a theory about duress, right? Or for a theory that under duress these things aren't binding, or you went in for a theory of you have a claim right for a mitzvah to be performed at fair market value, then it's not clear why Nesinas HaKesef should matter.
Right.
Right? So maybe this machlokes turns. This is Rabbeinu Yonasan against that day in the Meiri that disagrees. Maybe it turns on this idea of what you're saying, whether or not Gemiras Das is really what's at issue here in the Sugya. Or maybe, so Gemiras Das view versus the fair market value for a mitzvah versus duress considerations. Or maybe it's just even a machlokas about whether or not we can see kind of what Yoni was pushing back on earlier in the Zman. I think Yair also. He was Yair, I don't remember. Guys, remind me which one of the two of you it was. That the question of an agreement under duress or under situations of taos, right, of deception, is itself a question of a Gemiras Das. Remember we had on the board here, like, is this an issue of Gemiras Das or is it about the misrepresentation?
Oh, yeah.
Like the deception, right? So maybe you could say it's a similar question here, right? Well, Nisina Sakesef doesn't evidence Gemira's Das, right? If the Nisina Sakesef was just there to induce the guy to perform the service, it doesn't reflect that you had like real intent to go through with the stipulated amounts. Okay? But I think this is really interesting and very important machlokas. So Rabbi Yonason thinks once you pay, that locks in a stipulated for amount. Other Rishonim disagree. And they're clearly arguing about one of these, or I think they're arguing about one of these important questions here, either about what underlies the sugya, Gemira's Das versus other considerations, or the extent to which Nisina Sakesef really solidifies the Gemira's Das, or evidences Gemira's Das. Yoni.
Push back. Rabbi Yonason also adds a leader.
Yeah, the Onah stuff.
Was there because it's Onah. So wouldn't that imply? There's no Onah. Because otherwise had a loss. So doesn't that imply that you could suggest Rabbi Yonatan also thinks of some type of like fit halacha as interest in fair prices?
Yeah.
So, like the distinction is whether or not the money would be given or not.
Yeah.
Like once it's been given, so then halacha will have to return it because at that point it's determined that it is a fair price or what, because he does have a loss. But if you haven't given it yet, so then maybe you determine that fair price would have been not including potential loss. I don't know, were we establishing what is a fair price based on whether or not.
Well, it sounds like in Rabbeinu Yonason's reading here, he holds that there has to have been some sort of, there has to be some reasonable equivalency, or like the dinar itself has to have been in some ballpark reasonable for the services. Otherwise, he thinks that there would be like onah issues.
Sure, but doesn't that maybe suggest not that we're dealing with more than just fear of dot, but rather like a question of like halacha being interested in fair prices?
Yeah.
Like,
well, the way I would say it is that in order for Nisina Sakesef to solidify the Gemira's Das, you have to be within a ballpark where a Gemira's Das is acceptable, is within reach. And so if the price is so absurd, right, then even the Sinas HaKesef is not going to make a difference. But if you're in a reasonable range, because there's some hefsid, you're offsetting some hefsid from the ferryman, then it could constitute Gemira's Das. I think that's how the text here reads, as the best reading of the text. Now, I think it's different from the way the Rush is reading hefsid. Because the Rush is reading Hefsid as there's something about him suffering a loss that makes the stipulated for amount binding. And I think the Rimul Yonatan is saying that there's something about his loss that's going to bring the price stipulation back into a reasonable parameter, back into a reasonable range. Right, so the loss is actually offsetting some of the unreasonableness. But he disagrees with Rashi and the Meiri, who think that, oh, the loss has to really be equivalent to the stipulated price. It just has to bring you back into the ballpark of reasonableness. It alone would not make the stipulated amount binding. But then once you have Nisina Sakesef, that together with the reasonable price range is going to lock in the stipulated amount.
And then you could say that, but I think you can also argue
that he's a fair... He's a, but then why does he have to distinguish between the front-loaded payment and the non-front-loaded payment?
I think the argument would be that before you pay, so then fair pricing wouldn't relate to the money you get later, the losses that the ferryman would incur.
Oh, would that be?
Because, presumably, when you make a sale, sales are related to the exact product being given, not to, like, the size, conditions, especially if there are rituals involved, which is very important for Rabbeinu Yonatan.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. Let's put it this way. Even if you don't want to read this into... I mean, I don't agree with that way of looking at the Rabbeinu Yonatan. Now, we could hash it out more later, but I would just even skirt around the whole problem and say, well, if you don't want to read this into the Rabbeinu Yonatan, you can read it into this the way that you read.
Yeah, sure, okay. I think you could read it to read it at the time. I'm just not sure if you have to.
So run me one more time through your theory as to why you
think
if it's about, I'll point to you, if it's about fair market prices, Why should it matter whether you front load the money or pay after?
Because before you give them the money, so then I'll have interest in fair market prices, and it's not fair.
Okay.
After you've already given the money, so now halakha reconciles whether or not to make you pay back. It's going to determine that this external factor of the potential losses that are incurred by the fairman now become relevant enough that it's not fair for him to have to, it's not necessary to determine it. And then halakha in determining whether or not these external factors of the losses which the fairman will incur will distinguish whether or not the money's already been given or not. If it hasn't been given yet, so it's kind of irrelevant to the actual sale, to the actual...
Why? I mean, whether you actually pay is just a debt, right? I mean, it's... But the sale itself is, right, the transaction or the contract is happening.
Because when I ask for a product, like, I'm asking for the fair market price of that product. Like, who cares? Like, you might be also incurring a loss because you bought the product at too much of a price, or because, like, at the same time of the sale, you have your daughter's wedding. You know, there's a lot of, like, random other things that could happen at the same time, but that's not relevant.
Well, I'm just saying that, but you shouldn't conflate the payment of cash with the date of the sale, right? Because the date of the sale is when the obligation to pay is incurred. When you actually make the check is not...
So why is it relevant that you might be otherwise gaining more money if you didn't make the sale? Like, that's not relevant to the fair market price. Fair market price is how much it costs to go over a ferry.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the Nisina Samos is not bearing on the fair market.
No, because then I'm saying, so then I'll put... That's because a lot of dealing with two different types of questions. One question is, like, how much should you be paying? Another question, that's one question that comes to basing. Another question is if you already paid, now does basing, if it wants to make you recoup the money, right, is it fair to have the fairman give back the money?
Yeah.
And for that, then we have to determine from the fairman's perspective if we have to start calculating using the external cost also, because the fairman would have recovered, would have received some money from, you know, the losses he incurred.
Yeah, but wouldn't he be suffering those losses even if he didn't get the money fronted?
So what I'm saying is that because the loss was in with two different, there are two different questions in terms of, like, how is the period of cost. One question of should we pay and how much should we give back? So that will distinguish whether or not we care about the external considerations of these losses you will incur, or we not care about these external considerations.
I need to think about that. That's not my impression of what's going on in the Rimon Yovel, but we could dine on it more and go through the text unless anybody else wants to go through it now, or
I don't know. I'm becoming more sympathetic to the news as we go. I don't think my reading is more compelling than these cards. I'm just saying it both possible.
Alright. Fair enough. Let's talk more about this reading after. I think what's bothering me about it is just you don't get the sense that I get the sense that in order for Nisina Samos to matter, there has to be some sort of hefsid.
Nah, I think
the
Rabbinimus is raising a secondary kind of question, right? It's buying with Nisina Samos, great. Oh, what about Nah?
That's bad, right? That's bad for Yoni. Yeah, that's my reading.
That's Ismar's first reading. Yoni was kind of a side issue.
Yeah. So you're in my camp. You're in my camp. You're in my camp.
It does matter.
Right.
Very, very relevant.
Right.
In terms of calculating.
So we'll talk about it. Let's do more of it. We'll hash this out more later. Okay, but you're Yoni, even you're on board for the, at least the Miri and for the Bigri, the main point that the Nisina Samos is...
Yeah, I'm sorry it's possible.
Yeah.
But I agree.
Okay, good. Another consideration that's raised in the Rishonim, I think this is kind of sensible. So it comes up in Tosas Yivamos Daf Kavav Med Aleph. What's Tosas in Yivamos' view? That the only time we say that the parties are not bound by the stipulated or bargained for amount, believing Yair?
Yeah, I have been.
Huh?
I will unfortunately have to rejoin this year virtually later.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
All right.
Sorry.
Tosas and Yivamos Kavav has a different interpretation, has a different consideration that he brings to bear on the sugya. And he says the only time the parties are not bound by the bargain for amount is when, quote, Sheshoel davar gadol b'makom she'ein lochen ela davar muat. It's the bargain for amount is you're bargaining for an amount on a product or on a service that has very clear and fixed market prices. But if it's the kind of product or service that itself has large market fluctuations, meaning there are times when people will pay more than the market rate, hecha shelokchin davar gadol, right? Sometimes people will pay a lot of amount for this. Ein yochalor mishat ani b'cha, then you can't claim that I wasn't serious when I made the offer. Does everybody have traction on that idea of Tosos? Anybody have a sense of what Tosos is saying?
Does anybody disagree with this?
Well?
I'm not sure what is this a finish? Like, isn't that obvious?
So what's Tosos saying? I mean, what's the actual view?
Seems to be saying that anytime there's a certain, based on the market, we'll be able to determine how serious someone is being with their comments.
Yeah, I agree that he's saying that. But I'm interested, so to Yoni's point, right? Yoni's point is, well, how could you disagree with this, right? And I agree that Eitan's right. Conceptually, what's going on here is that he's thinking, well, it's a Gemira Stas issue, so if it's so exorbitant and unreasonable, then there can't be Gemira Stas. But if it's the kind of thing that, you know, people...
It could be a fair market.
Oh, so it depends what Tosos is saying, because I think the way I read Tosos is... Suppose the convict says, I'll pay you $1 million to cross the river. Now, it's true that the going rate for the ferry crossing is $5. And it's also true that sometimes people pay $10,000 for the ferry. Right? So, I think that's consistent with Tosis' idea that if it's the kind of thing that people sometimes overpay for, then any overpayment is going to be binding. See, that's one way of reading Tosos, which is different, I think, from the way Yoni, you're reading it, which is that, oh, if people sometimes pay this exorbitant amount, sometimes people pay $1 million for ferry crossing, then you are clearly bound by the stipulated for agreement. See what I'm saying, Yoni?
Yeah, I'm not sure which...
I'm not
terribly
clear about the 40-50 agreement between individual and corporate. Are you saying Yoni's agreement is the Gemira Stas point, and you think it's an independent point?
No.
Based on the market?
No, I'm saying that. Do you see the formulation of Tosis and Yevamah's poll?
Yeah.
So I'm saying that there are two possible readings of Tosos. Either that he's saying that, well, once people sometimes pay this exorbitant bargain for amount, then the parties are bound by it. Right? So look, most people pay $5 to cross the river. But in like weird scenarios when there are like weird market or inefficiencies or extreme weather conditions, people pay $10,000 to cross. So if you stipulated $10,000, that's going to be binding. That's one way of reading Tosos. The other way of reading Tosos, which I think is more consistent with his language, is that Tosos is saying that if this is the kind of thing that people overpay for, then your exorbitant stipulated for amount is going to be binding, even if it's totally out of whack with even the overpayment amount that's given for the services. Because Tosos,
you only think that the range, is binding.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you. Sorry.
You're good. The only, but look at the language. He says, right. So the only time you void the stipulated for amount and default to the going market rate is dafka kigon hacha sheshoel davar gadol b'makom she'ein lokchen ela davar muat. Aval hecha shelokchen davar gadol, when sometimes people pay a greater amount, ein yachalor mishat ani b'cha. So I guess the question...
Those are relative.
Right, so you're saying the Dover Guddles have to align.
Yeah. I think it's not reasonable to say that, like, you know, you go to there's an evil panty store owner, and he charges some children, you know, a quarter for, I don't know what a candy bar costs these days, but hey, candy. But if he charges some kids a quarter, he charges some kids $2. And that's like a 700% or whatever, 800% rate. So to say that, I mean, that's huge, in relative terms. But so to say, if you're going to come along and say, you know, the kid who charges $1,000, you know, that's on all fours with the
right.
charges, you know, 225, that doesn't sound so long.
Uh-huh. It's interesting. I mean, look here at so this is Tosus' theory. You'll see there are other Rishonim who express the same idea. Let's take a look at their formulations and see if they take a clearer stand on this. So you saw all these tshuvos of the Beis Medrash and the Marami Rutenberg, the Mordechai and the Tshuvos Maimonios. So they're interested in Shadchanim questions. Welcome back, Ben. So they're interested in the question of Shadchanim. So who wants to tell us a little bit, Yoni, or you want to tell us about the Shadchanim?
Well, there's like a basic machlokas, pretty much, whether or not if you're paying your a Shadchan, you know, who sets up your child or you. So you have to pay them like the rate that they ask, or you pay them just like the amount that it's your fault.
Yeah, so it sounds like people, the case is that I told the shotgun, I'll pay you $1 million if you find a girl for my son. Usually it goes the other way, but...
Woman.
Let's just do it this way. Right? So, I say, shotgun, you set up my kid, I'll give you $1 million. All right? And so it sounds like Mordechai wants to know if that's binding. Right? Is that analogous to the Boreach Mibeis Asurim case? And he wants to say... that you are, well, let's see, told you never have Irani in the Alascharo. So the Maram Paskin, who had in the Schar Shadchanim, She'ena Mufuy of Lasis Lokim Schar Tircha. Right? All you gotta pay is, like, let's say the market rate or the Schar Tircha.
It's not much lower than the market rate. Schar
yeah.
Tircha is like how much time to like, call someone.
Yeah. That's true. Although I'm not interested in that distinction yet.
Yeah, it was pretty low.
It's pretty low. Why? Presumably he's saying because there was no Gemiras Das, right? Everybody knows it's a guzma. Everybody knows it's an exaggeration when you say, I'm going to pay a shadchan $1 million to set up my kid. Ben, you agree? I mean, there's clearly no Gemiras Das. It's just out of whack. And so then it sounds like he's saying the underlying principle of the sugya is just that it's we could assume there was no Gemiras Das. Right? All the parties should know that it was out of whack.
If it was like a fair market price, then presumably it would be higher.
Yeah. Then he says, but I saw in the Or HaZeruah, quotes Rabbeinu Simcha, that no. Chayav l'aseis l'shadchan kol ma shehisna litein lo. And it's so you are obligated to pay the shadchan whenever you stipulated, and it's disanalogous to the ferry case. Why is it disanalogous to the ferry case? Why is it disanalogous?
That's
just
some
insidious
question.
It's like,
yeah, no, that's actually not the craziest.
Well, what does this line mean? Regilin lase yoser michte tircha.
So what? That's a hard job, so people pay a lot for it.
Yeah. Eight times, are you going to say?
Forget that, you know, that it's a hard job. It's just like this is. There seems to be some sort of precedent.
Yeah, there's practice. There's some sort of like minog that people pay a lot for shadchanim.
Well, I was going to say what Yaffe said before. Like, it's, I don't know if it's the same thing as like a duress situation, but it's almost like I don't want to talk about like you know the shadchanim etc. But like, if you're going to a shadchan, it seems like unless you're like in a certain belt, it's like oh, this is a last resort. Sort of
yeah, it depends. We have to know what their belt was like, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
Well, it could just be that there's no really market value for shadchanim because people that totally fluctuate depending on. Using the phrase, but how desperate you are.
Desperate.
Yeah.
How wealthy the people are. Maybe they're like, hey, I need you to find one. I don't care what the price is.
Right.
Because theoretically, you're saying like people pay a lot, but like that's like okay, there's gonna be like difference between a million and like 10,000.
That's exactly what I want to know, right? That's exactly what we're interested in here. So, is he saying that when you stipulate $1 million to pay a shadchan, right? So that's going to be binding because people overpay shadchanim anyway. Right? So he's saying, look, the true market value for a shadchanis service is $100 per shidduch. You agreed to pay $1 million. You're bound by that because people pay well over the $100 amount anyway. People pay $10,000. So the important point in the Mordechai is to say, well, if it's the kind of thing that people overpay for, then there's no, you have no right to assume that your stipulated amount was a guzma, because people always overpay for the service, right? I.e., maybe that means it has no real market value and it's just based off agreement, which I think leans in more towards my reading of Tosfos. Right? The crucial point is that you pay kol ma'ase hisne because divadavar zeh regidin lasis yoser michtei tircha. People overpay.
You don't think that there's a reasonable clause here?
Is that Gabe?
Yeah.
I don't see a reasonable clause in the Mordechai, right? I see Yoni's read definitely has a reasonable clause all over it. Look, I mean, Gabe.
I agree with you on this.
Well?
I agree with you here. I think it means whatever price you agreed, after you agreed.
Yeah, so Yoni's with me on this one, Gabe. What are your thoughts?
It's so intuitive to assume that what we're trying to figure out is what's reasonable to pay for this item. The reason we care about what's ragil, what people normally do, is because we want to know what is considered a normal payment for this product. So the real question is just, is the price for this service predicated on the cost of the service, or is it not like the cost of the service and is defined by the market?
Interesting. I would push back on your... I think if you're making two separate points here, both are interesting. I would push back on the first point and say, I don't think it's fair to say that everybody agrees we're trying to figure out what the fair market value is. Rather, like similar to what Cole was saying earlier, the halacha recognizes that parties can make whatever agreements they want on the price. The only time we'll invalidate an explicit agreement between the parties is if it's so out of whack, right? Meaning there's no rational basis for it. But generally there's a presumption that we want to uphold agreements between parties and their subjective valuations, right? The only time we'll invalidate it is if there's no rational basis. The moment shadchanis is a service that's not fixed by clear-cut market values, it's the kind of thing that people generally overpay for, then we have to honor the party's agreement. Do you hear that, Gabe? That's how I would make sense of this.
I hear what you're saying. I'm not intuitively going to respect it. I can't prove it's more effective, but like, if you pay 100 times what the max that anybody's ever paid for shadchanis, like, chances are you're just exaggerating.
Yeah.
You don't understand anything.
Yeah, so I think, you know, yeah, maybe I'm... I'm not sure what I think about that yet, because is the right thing to say there that, oh, there is no clear-cut market value, which is one thing you could say, or is it rather what you're saying, which is that the market value has a certain range and we should defer to that, right? Gabe?
Yeah, I guess the way goods or services are priced doesn't need to be linked to tircha, and that's what the Mordechai is pointing out.
Yeah.
Not that they have no reasonable range at all.
Yeah. That's the second point, which I think relates to Yoni's point, that how significant is the kedei tircho idea here, right? So I want to say that kedei tircho is not so significant. That's just like how they assume the standard way to price out a shadchan's salary is, what the salary is, but... even if you priced it out in terms of what people are paying going market rates, still that's not going to fix the whole point of the Mordechai is they were not locked into that market rate. Gabe, you're like an economics guy, right?
Economics has nothing to do with law.
No, but I think I think there is a very interesting underlying kind of theory of economics question about like what constitutes of like what constitutes the fair market price for these kinds of services, right? And to what extent we think the law should defer to these kind of vague market prices versus
an economic question. That's just an appropriation of
it. No, I think the economic question is whether what does it mean, what constitutes markets for these things, right? So what's the market, what's the fair market value for shadchana services? Right, I think that's, so people are paying all sorts of different things for it, right? So what's the fair market value? And I think one way you could go is to say that means there is no fair market value, right? There's no market price because the fluctuations are so variable. The other thing you can say is like, no, the market rate is like, within those reasonable fluctuations or some like weighted average of the fluctuations.
So you get to impact or now change what the range is by giving...
Yeah, this what this price itself factors
in. You could say, oh,
yeah, now it spikes up. Yeah, right. Gabe, do you have any thoughts on this?
No, I think that the pricing question is essential here, right? Another angle on the pricing question is, in particular context, can a service be worth more to an individual than the market value? So
yeah.
A person's sort of freedom and liberty is on the line, whether they're going to end up in jail or not end up in jail. And a ferry might not be worth $5, it might be worth $1 million.
Right.
That's what they pay for their liberty.
It has greater value to him in that context. Yeah, I agree, yeah. I think I'm going to try to see if there's a way to weigh in more on these questions. Cole, do you agree to Gabe that there are genuine economic considerations here that are non-legal, that are not reducible to like the legal appropriations of economics?
No. I mean, like, economic considerations are about the... I just think it's the law using... I think it's basically appropriation.
I think what Gabe is... Well, I think there are legitimate questions here about conceptualizing market pricing mechanisms, right? I think that would be a genuine consideration in the background.
Here's the libertarian thing that the highest thing you can say, there's no such thing as a price for anything. If you were to say, what's the price of milk? That question has no answer. The price of milk is, there are local matters of fact about the price of milk. The price that you got it for at the store, the price I got it for at the store.
Right.
And there's a kind of...
That's right, because libertarians are freedom of contract people, right? It's all just by agreement.
Exactly, right. So clearly the halakha does not believe that there is no... The libertarian thing is, what's the price of X? Nonsense question.
Yeah.
Which I think is a brilliant theoretical point, and the halakha does not believe in that. Not because it believes that as a normative matter doesn't believe in it. Not because, for a number of reasons. Because, we don't want to see people taking advantage of others and whatever. But these strike me as not basically. There is an interesting point, about what counts as the range.
Okay. Yeah.
I hear that.
Yeah.
For a shotgun, you could imagine, for shotgun, that's one of the things where I don't want to objectify anybody, but there are probably definitely communities where it's the case that the perceived, where it's not just like a standard rate, or it's not just like, $5,000 right, that you owe to your future husband or wife, where, you go to the person and you're like, hey, your daughter's marrying the son of the Mr. Rothschild. I'd like to be rewarded for that in some sense.
Right.
So there's going to be a much longer range.
Yeah. Yeah. This is kind of what Eitan was saying also. This, do the markets consider... Does the fair market value, or if you're averaging market, what people pay, does it include like this bargain itself, right? So like here's an offer for $1 million. Now that like distorts the, the market average or something. All right. I just want to point out that in the same Mordechai, he quotes the smag. So whenever we see Sefer HaMitzvos in the Chachmei Ashkenaz, it's the smag. Who says, Dehu adin le'inyan refuos, de derech litein damin meruba. And I think it's velo nomar bezeh sichek bo. Because people, it's common for people to pay an exorbitant amount for medicine, so we can't say that it's mishatabo. We can't say that he's just messing around. So I think this is, you see, I think this taps into the Gemara's Das point. Given that people pay damin meruba for medicines, right? So then we don't have good reason to say that there was no Gemara's Das when the party stipulated on that amount, right? Because it's normal for people to overpay. So I think that works towards both my general reading of Tosos and to kind of Eitan's underlying reading of it, that this is a Gemara's Das question. Right? Is there a rational basis for your overpaying? And we're saying yes, because practice is that people overpay. Okay. Good. Any further thoughts on this idea? So let me get out the last two components of the sugya here in the last 9 minutes of our the chabura. So some other rishonim, and this is also in the Beit Yonasan. So they seem to think that underlying the sugya is a different principle. That the real principle here is the fact that when a mitzvah is involved, there's, I guess, a duty to perform the mitzvah at a normal market value, a normal price. And correlatively, I think there's a claim right for the recipient, for the beneficiary, to have mitzvahs performed, mitzvahs that are owed to him performed at a reasonable market rate. So you can see here, for example, the Mordechai in Simen Kufayin Gimel. So in Bava Kamma. So he talks about the case of Borech Mibes HaAsurim. He says that the convict can say Meshata Nibacha. He says, V'taima Dehu Mesukan, because the convict is somebody who's in Sakana. V'chayev Lahatzilo V'lito Schar Torcho. There's a duty of assistance. There's a duty to rescue the guy. And what does the halacha provide as compensation for your duty to rescue him? What does the halacha provide? Schar tircha. Right? So, not only is there a general duty to... Not only is there a general duty of assistance, I guess in a correlative claim right to be assisted, but the pricing of performing that duty is factored in. It's part of the duty that you have is to perform it and only recover schar tircha. Right? V'hachanami... And then Tosa says, by extension, mitzvah lahavi refua lechola. Right, under a similar kind of theory, place of that Gemara in Bava Kamma, there's a duty to heal somebody who's sick. And I guess implicitly that the duty to heal only entitles you to some kind of schar tircha, right? Some sort of fair market value for the service or recovering your costs. And then that vitiates the background stipulated for amount, right? The halakhic obligation to perform the service at the fair value. Let me just point out that the Rimi Luneel seems to have a formulation that focuses on mitzvah. He says, why can't you say Mishat Anibacha? And he says, Daha mitzvah hi lahatzil behemas chavero bischar. Right? There's a mitzvah to help rescue somebody's struggling animal, bischar, and to be compensated at the amount that the Torah stipulates for you.
Is there anybody
who doesn't believe in the mitzvah exception? The Ramban thinks that it's not about mitzvahs.
What do you mean it's not about? Do you think that in a case of mitzvah, there's no...
He thinks that if there's a stipulated, he thinks a stipulated back, a background stipulated agreement would override the duty to perform the mitzvah. To perform the mitzvah at a certain market value.
Did you include the Ramban?
Yeah, it's the Torah Sadam in the next source.
But also, Tosfos disagree with the converse implication. And then the implication.
Yeah, yeah, Torah's Adam is the Ramban. It's the Ramban Sefer on Rafua and Sakana and Velos.
Oh, I would have done that with credit.
Right, I'm sorry. That's right.
I would have read it carefully.
You should have known Kabbalah Torah not to mean the Ramban.
Right.
I mean, I just want to point out something that the Rebbe Gil, who's a mitzvah man,
he interestingly seems to take mitzvah in a slightly different direction. Look at the last Rimilu meal before the Ramban. He says, "Ein lo ela scharo hanahug b'chol yom, dematzi lemeimar le mitzvah hi de'avdis, she mitzvah hi lahatzi leini." It's not clear so much what he means by that, but he's saying it's like the person rescued has a valid claim to say that the reason why you perform the mitzvah, the reason why you perform the assistance, is to satisfy or to discharge your mitzvah obligation. Like, you didn't perform it for the reason of recouping the stipulated for payment. See that? So, how do you understand that phrase, right? It's just the hechatimtzi to argue mishatani b'cha, like, demotzi lemeimar le mitzvah hidavdus she mitzvah... What?
The Ramban? Which is, yeah, like Shaka Bach is anything. I mean, the Mordechai is a principle, which is, you know, the Mordechai has a reason what Ramban is saying, that, you know, Shaka Bach is also a living principle. But, like, is the Ramban going to say anything goes?
Well, the Ramban here, let me just get the
Ramban. The next thing about the mitzvah principle is that it has to do with why it limits the right of the ferry driver to charge something exorbitant. It's very clean, theoretical. Shabbat is like, who's Shabbat?
Right.
That's like anything.
Well, I think the Ramban's theory is that it's a theory of duress, right? Agreements made under duress are not really binding. I think that's what the Ramban's getting at. So it's the halacha doesn't want to recognize stipulated for agreements under conditions of tchak.
The problem with these cases is that, so like a classic direct case is not binding. Like, the classic direct case is like somebody holding a gun to your head, loss is not like four
million games.
It's not.
So good. I think one very important question is, how do you relate this Ramban? Let me just say what the Ramban says, because we kind of. So there's this mitzvah view out there. That's the Remy Lanil's view. Ramban also quotes it as
and the Mordechai
and the Ramban quotes it as a Yesh Omrim in Torah Adam. The Ramban disagrees primarily because he thinks that it can't be sustained by all the sugyas, specifically the chalitza case. He thinks that you can't really view a chalitza as a mitzvah in that case. So it's not true that all the cases, the agreement is vitiated by the duty to perform a mitzvah. So the Ramban says what's really going on here is that shasat chak is decisive. So the conditions of duress annihilate the bindingness or the force of the previously agreed for amount. That's the Ramban's theory. So I think it's an interesting question. It raises a super interesting question about duress in general, and specifically, how do you relate this halacha about duress according to the Ramban with other halachos like Toluah v'Zavin Zvini Zvini, which seem to say that a sale made under duress is valid, right, Cole?
Yeah.
So we have to address those questions. But this is basically, we have to, let's stop here, because at least we got out all the shitas. I want us to think about some of these shitas before Thursday. What the pluses and minuses of different views are and how they relate to each other. What the underlying theory for each view is. And then we'll come back Thursday. I'll add a few more makoros and we'll wrap up this general discussion and try to summarize and extract the main principles before we move on. All right? Good. Okay, so we'll stop here and we'll pick up with this analysis.
Can we spend 30 seconds talking about putting your head together or something?
About getting you and I or the whole Chabura?
No, the whole, the Ganza.
Wait, so when are you here? You're here Monday and Tuesday?
I'm here Monday and Tuesday.
Are you here this Thursday?
Next.
Okay, Monday, Tuesday, you're here. So fine, let's see. Let me see what we can do on those two.
What week? This week, next week, December 23rd.
The next week, not today and tomorrow.
The 15th.
He's here the 23rd, 24th. No, Cole, you're here.
2 weeks.
No, Cole, you're here this
week.
Next week.
Yeah, you're
right, he's here for a wedding.
Next
week.
The next week is the
Fan. I know. He wants this thing anyway. We'll get together with Cole, Kenner. We'll see. Yeah. All right, Cole. I'll speak to you about it. Let me see. I'll make the introductions. We got to get Gabe and Yakir in.
You guys are part of that. You guys are all voices on the phone.
Right. Oh, fine. So let's see what we can do, and then we'll...
All right.
Shkoyach, everyone. So we're going to wrap up this sugya Thursday morning. Our next sugya is going to be the Chazara sugyas. About when the Baal HaBayis wants to back out, when the Poel wants to back out. So both, when is each party allowed to back out, and what are the damages for doing so?
I feel like it's a sugya for when that's not